books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood. And coming up today, we have a period novel weaving a dark and thrilling tale of intrigue, power and complicity in Hester Musson's The Beholders. Plus, as always, we'll find some brand new books out commercially and from RNIB Talking Books. June 1787. The body of a boy is pulled from the depths of the River Thames, suspected to be the beloved missing child of the widely acclaimed Liberal MP, Ralph Gethin. 4 months earlier, Harriet is a young maid, newly employed at Finton Hall, fleeing the drudgery of an unwanted engagement in the small village where she grew up. Harriet is entranced by the grand country hall. She is entranced too by her glamorous mistress, Clara Gethin, whose singing floats through the house. But Clara, though captivating, is erratic. The master of the house is a much lauded politician, but he is strangely absent, and some of their beautiful belongings seem to tell terrible stories. I'll talk to author Hester Musson in a moment, but for now, the audio version is narrated by Ashley Tucker, with Harriet Carmichael and Elliot Fitzpatrick.
Finton Hall, February, Wednesday, the 27th of February. Letter from Mother, as expected.
Dear Harriet, thank you for the money you sent us last week. How much better for us all if you brought it home with you yourself. Your letter has put me about, I won't pretend otherwise, and you know the reason. What am I to tell your father and sisters? You must know that your father is no better. The doctor took me to one side yesterday to say his lungs are so weak he may not be able to work for months, if at all. These last years in the quarry have told on him. I always said it would come to no good, digging up farmland for stones, and now they are after building an ironworks too, I'm told. Much good it will do your family. Your youngest sister is to be scullery maid at Beechwood, but you know how little we can expect from that. Your money will at least pay for the aprons and caps she needs. The rest will have to be put by for the doctor. James Stanworth, who was always so good to us, is leaving for America, and we cannot trust on Lady Stanworth's kindness forever. If there wasn't William waiting, I would give thanks that you had found such a good place. I asked the new butler at Beechwood if he knew of Mr. and Mrs. Gethin. I pretended I was asking for your father's cousin's child. That is the wretched position you have put me in. And he said there is much talk in London of Mr. Gethin doing great things for the country and for workers with his modern ideas. But there is no reason for you to stay in service now, Harriet. William, as you surely know, is to be made head gardener and have the Mill Lane cottage. You could ensure your father's comfort and put all our minds at rest. I only hope you have not lost sight of yourself. William is still most kind and loving to us all. That is something else we cannot trust on forever. With love, Mother.
It's set in 1878 and it begins with the trial of a woman who is the wife of an MP and she's accused of murdering their baby son. But the story then jumps back a few months and it's told completely through the diaries of a housemaid called Harriet Watkins, who goes to work for them at their country estate. And Harriet is trying to find a way out of her own limited life choices. She doesn't want to go home and marry her childhood sweetheart, which is what's expected of her. And is really the only sensible thing for her to do in her position, because she doesn't want to be a housemaid either. That's a very hard life and precarious one as well. She's looking for a bigger purpose and she thinks she's found it working in this amazing house, Finton Hall, for these amazing employers. She's particularly captivated by her mistress, Clara, who lives to sing and fills the house with her singing voice. And she seems to see more in Harriet than anyone else ever does. And she doesn't see the master very much to begin with, but he's in London a rising star of the Liberal Party. She feels like maybe this is a life of service which would have more meaning for her. But as she begins to understand what's really going on in Fintan Hall, she starts to doubt her decision. It looks like a fairy tale to start with, but the hall's actually quite sinister. There's things going on which she becomes much more uneasy about. And in the end, she has to make a choice about how far she's willing to go and how much she's prepared to risk to do what she thinks is the right thing.
Friday, the 1st of March. I'm on the floor in the pantry, so I'll be out of sight if someone comes into the kitchen. There's a drawer in the dresser there where I keep this book, but I'll be finding a new place for it now there's something in it to read. It's so perfect and weighty in its green cover, so expecting of a better hand I've been half afraid of it. I've been waiting for a minute's quietness or for something to happen that's worthy of disturbing the lovely blankness of the page. But there's neither peace nor interest to be had at Fintan Hall. So this is how I'm starting in earnest, hurriedly scratching out in pencil whatever comes to mind, sitting between a sack of beetroot and an old milk churn.
I was interested in themes around service, and so it became about service and power and how our perception of both of those things can be so distorted that terrible things can happen right in front of us without us really being able to see it.
And what sort of drew you to that time period of the 1870s?
Well, it was originally, the story was going to be set in the present, a very different story, but it was going to have a sort of subplot of these little diary entries sort of ticking along in the background. And my main character, who was trying to unravel a mystery of the past, doesn't actually read them. The reader does until the very end when she finds the entire diary. But I started writing the little diary inserts and they just completely took over. Once I had Harriet's voice, it just wouldn't shut up. And so in the end, I was like, oh, well, this has to be the entire book. And I've always been fascinated by the Victorian period. It was set particularly when it is really to serve the book that never got written because it needed to be a certain number of generations. But once I got into that period, it made sense for a lot of reasons.
Now, setting it in that time will involve a bit of research. Did you read any real diaries from the period?
Yes, as much as possible. I mean, there aren't that many that I could find servants' diaries available. I think perhaps they just weren't written because they just didn't have time to. There was one that was very influential, which was by a woman called Hannah Colwick. The only reason she wrote her diary was because she was having a love affair with a barrister and he was fascinated by servants and wanted to know all about her daily life. So sort of begrudgingly, she did start writing a diary for him. And it's so interesting because she begins by just really listing chores that she had to do every day, which was brilliant for research. But then as she writes, the writing obviously became more important to her and she starts to, it's almost like a confidant. She starts to figure things out and, you know, she'll even complain about her relationship. It obviously becomes very important to her. So that was really useful to use for thinking about Harriet as well, because Harriet, she also, I nicked the idea, she doesn't really want to write a diary, but one of her former employer asks her to. She says her handwriting will become neater if she writes every day, so why doesn't she write a diary? And throughout the book, she starts to wonder why she's writing it. And towards the end, she starts to realise that it's not actually her own story that she's been recording. Her whole diary has been a kind of act of witnessing, and that's why it's been important.
Yeah, it's hard to discuss it in any depth without giving away spoilers. Did that real diary inform the pacing of the book? Because it starts off quite domestic and then it ramps up the pace somewhat. So did that inform the book?
I think, because although Hannah Colwick's diaries are absolutely fascinating to read, if you read them as a novel, they'd be very disappointing. So for Harriet's diary, it was about sort of treading this line between what was completely implausible, because nobody writes a diary, you know, as this book reads, but keeping enough of it to feel real. So you never lose sight of the fact that it is a diary and think, oh, this is just ridiculous. So it was just always treading that line. And of course, it's a novel. It has to have pacing. And that was a challenge with it that I hadn't actually expected. It was really difficult because it's quite hard to keep a sense of jeopardy when you know that your protagonist, whatever's happened in that scene, is sitting somewhere safely writing, you know, because they have to be, because they're writing it in real time. So I had to find ways to sort of keep the suspense going so that, yeah, so that it wasn't, didn't just sort of grind to a halt. And it's like, well, she's fine.
We'll continue that chat with Hester Musson in a moment, but for now, let's cross over to the RNIB Talking Books Library to find some more brand new books.
We have the latest blockbuster in the Alex Cross series by James Patterson, Alex Cross Must Die, which was donated by Penguin Random House.
On that mid-November Monday morning, after nearly 3 years of careful planning, the 48-year-old man donned latex gloves and scanned the rental car agreement one last time. His eyes paused on the flowing signature Marion Davis before he stuffed the agreement into an aluminum clipboard storage box, the kind construction estimators use. He set it on plastic sheeting on the credenza in a dingy motel room not far from Joint Base Andrews. Davis had been there the past 3 days. He told the young woman at the front desk that he was holing up to finish his first movie script. His claim seemed to impress her enough that she agreed to keep housekeeping away, which was good, because how could he have explained the thin plastic sheeting covering every bit of furniture and taped over the floors and walls? Or, even harder to explain, the four large plastic storage bins he'd bought at Walmart and filled with bleach, hydrogen peroxide, and distilled water.
When an American Airlines plane explodes in the sky, detectives Alex Cross and John Sampson are first on the scene. They don't hear the gunfire at first. The weapon that took down the plane is a remote-controlled Vietnam War-era machine gun. The list of those who possess the training and expertise to operate the stolen 50-caliber weapon is short, and time runs even shorter. But this isn't the only case the pair must solve. They're also tracking a serial killer who's ambushing young men in what the media are calling the Dead Hours murders. With two killers and two different motives, Cross and Sampson are in a deadly race against time.
The acrid chemical scent irritated Davis's eyes and nose, but he didn't dare open the windows for ventilation. Instead, he'd kept the air conditioner going nonstop and wore goggles and a KN95 mask. He left the room only in the dead of night, when it was safe to ferry supplies. Now Davis crouched by the closest storage bin, reached with gloved hands into the chemical solution, and pulled out a long belt of 50-caliber bullets, bought 2 years before in the blackest of black markets, this one at a remote ranch in northern Colorado. He knew from training and experience that a soldier could adjust his aim at a moving target by using this ammunition belt. Every fourth cartridge fired a tracer round that glowed hot orange as it sped through the air. However, the tracers also revealed the position of the shooter. Davis left in the first four tracer rounds, but removed the remaining ones and replaced them with live rounds from a second bleached ammunition belt. When he was done, he sank the first belt back in the chemicals and went into the bathroom. There, Davis stripped off his clothes and put them in a plastic garbage bag that he closed and sealed with duct tape. Next, he stepped into the shower stall, all but the drain covered in plastic sheeting, turned on the hot water, picked up a razor, and shaved every inch of skin he could reach, from his already shaved head to the insteps of his feet.
Alex Cross Must Die by James Patterson is narrated by Wayne Carr, Inger Tudor, Zeno Robinson, William Stevens, Peter Giles, Jim Meskimen, and Kef Vandelhoevel, and runs for 8 hours and 51 minutes.
For those who like their crime cozier, Strictly Come Dancing judge Shirley Ballas has written her first book. It's called Murder on the Dance Floor and was gifted by HarperCollins.
It would have shocked absolutely no one to hear that Lily Richmond was striding through the corridors of the Whitby Pavilion. Least of all, Lily herself. This was, after all, the United Kingdom's open to the World Ballroom and Latin Dance Championship. And she, a legend. Samba Queen. International Dance Champion 1983 through to 1996, when she graciously stepped aside to give others a chance to enjoy the limelight. Owner of the Lily Richmond Dance Studio, where she mentored and taught dozens of champions, many of whom were here today. And, of course, renowned ballroom dance judge. An expert whose opinion meant the world to competitors on the scene because, after all, a top mark from Lily was all the gilding one needed. So, no, her presence was no great surprise. What was reverberating through the myriad of dancers, makeup artists and stylists jammed into the backstage corridors and dressing rooms of the pavilion was the slow dawning realization that Lily Richmond had not checked in at the sponsors' table at any point this evening. Nor had she been announced as one of the expert judges who would stand at one of nine tactical viewing points around the lightly sprung hardwood floor, her violet eyes glued to the dancers like a hawk, marked sheets shifting from her hands to the scrutineers, discreetly crushing, no, realigning, couple after couple's dreams of following in her wake. Not even for the United Kingdom Open to the World Amateur Rising Star Latin competition. And my goodness, that stung.
Behind the sequence and sparkle of Blackpool Tower Ballroom's famous dance festival, the competition is about to turn deadly. When a promising young dancer collapses during the opening tango of the festival, Lily Richmond, dance legend, teacher and one-time world champion, is convinced that murder is afoot. There's only one person who can help her delve into the mystery, her former student and private detective, Susie Cooper. But Susie vowed she'd never return to the ballroom, let alone go undercover as a professional dancer when there's a killer on the loose. As the competition gets even fiercer and the bodies start to pile up, can the unlikely dance detective duo unravel the rumours from the rumbas and expose the murderer's identity before they strike again?
It's like holding the BAFTAs, a dancer whispered as she passed, and forgetting to invite Dame Judy.
In the past, Lily would have been consumed by humiliation. Not only was striking her off the list of judges a very public blow to her expertise, the timing was vicious. Shaming her just a few short weeks before the all-hallowed Blackpool Ballroom Bonanza? How very dare they! Her first instinct had been to launch into action, seek revenge. It certainly would have taken the edge off. However, it struck her, as she made her way toward the dressing rooms, that there was something else that could be just that little bit better. Winning. If her couples swept the board in place of those who danced for the powers that be, wouldn't it be fun at photo time? As she pictured the scene, a smile teased at her lips. Yes, she decided, it would. And she had nothing but full confidence in her dancers. So, she'd play the game. Laugh, smile, wave off her onlooker status as something she'd been fully briefed on. But behind the facade, if someone was really asking, there was little but fury and pain.
Murder on the Dance Floor, the Sequin Mysteries, Book 1 by Shirley Ballas, is narrated by Claire Corbett and runs for 10 hours, 55 minutes.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Plus, you can enjoy a book for the younger listener or young at heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery.
enjoy your favourite Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.
And now a return to Hester Musson on her book, The Beholders.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Now, you said it's a diary of her witnessing things. Is that where the title, The Beholders, came from?
Yes. The book, when I was writing it, its sort of working title was called Eye Service, which was from a biblical quote addressed to servants saying to work diligently at all times, not with eye service as men pleasers, meaning don't just work when you think someone's watching you. But the title had to go because I told it to a friend and she asked if it was set in an optician's. So I was like, okay, no. But that was the idea, doing things just when people are watching you, this sort of fake way of working from servants to politicians. And there's a lot in the book about perception and about the people who can see or really know what's going on are often the people who can't actually speak about it without getting into trouble or endangering someone else or sort of treading that line. So there's lots of sort of angles of how people perceive things and how different things present, especially how power can present to people.
You think she's reliable, but she is quite an unreliable narrator.
Yes, that was really fun to play with, especially as a diary. So the actual book itself is part of the action, and diaries can be read by the wrong person or stolen. So it was great to make her an unreliable narrator. And because she's aware of how risky it is to write things down, you know, maybe sometimes she's being unreliable on purpose. So that was really fun.
Is Fintan Hall based on anywhere?
I sort of auditioned country houses when I was writing it to try and find one that fit. And it's not a direct setting, but Hughenden Hall, where Disraeli actually, who was a prime minister, lived, I found the most useful and pinched things from it, but it's certainly not a direct representation of it.
Now, we've heard a clip of the audio version, which is narrated by Ashley Tucker, Harriet Carmichael and Elliot Fitzpatrick. Did you have any choice in the narrators, and were you involved in the decision to make it a triple narrated book?
I had very little to do with it, but actually more than I had expected to. I thought it would just go away and be handled. I was sent some clips of actors for Harriet with what the team thought would be right. So I did have a say in it, which was really nice, and I agreed with them, which was handy. But I didn't have anything to do with the actual recording. What was lovely, though, because although most of it is read by Ashley Tucker, there are a few little inserts of newspaper articles and the court proceedings, and those are read by different people, which is a really nice touch, and that was their idea, which I absolutely thought was great. But one of them, Harriet Carmichael, I was actually in a play with, a couple of plays actually on tour about 18 years ago, and we hadn't spoken since, but it was so lovely that she did it, and she's called Harriet. It all sort of fell into place.
Mrs. B gave me the book in Gloucester Square about a month before she died. She said I'd get better at writing if I kept a diary to show her. I thought she just wanted to hear servants' gossip firsthand. But maybe I should have listened. My letters are so cramped and uneven. They look ashamed of themselves. I'm supposed to be washing up, but when I came down, there was no one here. Mrs. Clarkson has a rest about now, and Mary's cleaning the upstairs rooms. As far as she cleans anything. Lawrence slinks off somewhere, probably to lord it over the stable lad, when he should be ready to open the door to visitors. Not that anyone ever comes. He'll be back before Mrs. Clarkson shows a big round face again, that's certain. She says her name in this voice, Mrs. Clarkson. It's supposed to be from when she worked in France, but it made me smile first time she said it, especially as her face is so round. Like a handsome clock face. I shouldn't have done that. She said, something amusing you, Harriet? Though it sounded like, something amusing you, Harriet, which didn't help. Someone's come into the kitchen. And I didn't get up right away. My feet ache so. It's as if they've been walloped. So now I can't. I don't know who it is. They are so quiet, I keep thinking they've gone. but then there's a sigh or a shuffle again.
Yeah, you have an acting background. Do you not fancy being one of the voices yourself?
I thought about it for about 5 seconds, but I think it's a very long time since I've done any acting, so I didn't feel entirely confident that I would be able to do it justice, as much justice as a professional. But also, to be honest, I was kind of curious to see what someone else would do with it. I like the idea of the book kind of going out and finding new ways of expression and just seeing what other people do with it. It's almost like you can never hear what a reader is hearing in their head, but this is the sort of closest thing to it, is hearing someone else read it.
Is that part of the writing process? Do you read it out to yourself out loud, especially during the dialogue scenes, to make sure it flows?
Yes, I do. I usually leave it until I've finished it all, and then I read it all through. But I think I'm going to change that, because it is so useful to read it. And I just yesterday, actually, I had to do some readings myself for the first time and thought, oh, I really wish I'd read these through at this pace. And because it's obviously such a big job to read through an entire book. But I think once I'm pretty sure of a scene, I think I will actually start reading it out loud at that point, because it is very useful.
Now that it's available in audio, is accessible to anyone regardless of their relationship with print, is that important that it's now accessible?
Yes, yeah, of course. Yes, I think it's a question of choice. I think it's important people have a right not to read my book as much as to read it. It should be an option. I think because books and stories they're really a very odd form of communication between people. It's like a sort of weird conversation that can be paid forward and can leap across time and space. Stories are such an ancient way of us connecting with each other. I think it's our birthright, really, as human beings. So it's important that as many people as possible can access as wide a range of stories and voices as possible.
Now, one thing we won't get if we download the audio version of the book is the cover. Can you give us a little description of it?
Yeah, sure. It's a very lavish cover. It's very beautiful. There's a depiction of a grand house in the lower half, which is a sort of dark green colour, and the windows are all lit with gold. And in them, there are silhouetted three figures, which is the master and mistress of the house. And then downstairs, there's Harriet, the housemaid. And behind that and swirling all over the cover is this foliage where there's some green in there, but most of it is this bright orangey red. And you can see that it's actually, rather than foliage, it's flames, and it all curls round, and there are sort of hothouse flowers in it with pink in them as well. And throughout all of that, there are little motifs from the book. So there's a pear in there, because pears feature in a sinister way. And there's a needle and thread, because Harriet is a great seamstress. And she talks about stitching being like writing, the sort of stitch by stitch, word by word process, which adds up to something bigger. And there's also, which was a stroke of genius, I think, from Andrew Davis, who designed it, a figure in the top left, all in orange and yellow, of a fallen angel, essentially. Paradise Lost by Milton is referenced in the book, and the idea about this, what something that was once beautiful falling from grace and becoming something evil. And behind all of that, the very last background is black. So where the beholders, the title is, just behind that in the middle, it's actually left black. So it's sort of like the dark heart of the story, which is really lovely.
And it's got that byline as well in some versions.
Yes, it's not actually on the one that's in front of me, but some houses are haunted by the living, which I absolutely love that. That wasn't me at all. That was someone on the team who came up with that, and I thought that was brilliant.
If you're listening to this on the day it was broadcast and podcast, the book came out yesterday. How's the whole process been for you?
It's been really exciting and fun. And it's publishing is a mysterious, strange world. So it's I've just really, really enjoyed it. And I think I'm quite glad in a way, because this is actually my third book. I've been writing for 15 years before I got this book deal. I'm quite grateful in a way that I am now this age, because I think, 10 years ago, even, I think I'd have got quite stressed and angsty, whereas I think now I kind of feel like this all feels like a huge bonus. I'm just feel very lucky to be here and doing this. So it's just been all good so far.
If I'm caught, there will be trouble. Mrs. Clarkson doesn't just look like a clock. All our timings are set by her. Somehow she eats up the minutes like she's always running fast. However hard I work, I'm behind time. Duncan, the coachman, says it's her job to pick the household servants, and her nose is out of joint because the missus employed me without telling her. I can believe it. She loves telling us all what a wonderful housekeeper she is, and how the master hired her on the spot when he overheard her giving a knife cleaner the scolding of his life in her last place. Whatever the reason, she doesn't like me. She came tick-tocking around when I was scrubbing the floor in the morning room earlier and used her foot to point out where I needed to go over a bit, then gave me a sharp kick on the leg to hurry me up. I turned and looked at her, which she didn't like. "Don't slant your eyes at me like that." Then something in French. "There is a deal of work to be done before the master gets home. All high horse." I told her I found it a deal easier to do my work quickly when I wasn't being kicked. She narrowed her eyes at me then and gave a nasty secret smile. "We won't have to worry about you when the master's home. You'll find he won't want your sort upstairs."
The Beholders by Hester Musson is available now in ebook, as a hardback, and in audio, as read by Ashley Tucker with Harriet Carmichael and Elliot Fitzpatrick. It's available both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books. And Hester, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And Hester will return at the end of today's show with the books of her life. But for now, let's return to the RNIB Talking Books library to find some brand new audio releases.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
New in the library is the thriller Stay by Jane Bailey, which was donated by Orion.
Every weird family is weird in its own way. I should have spotted straight away that this was a weird one. Instead, given the state I was in, I just thought it might be a bit of fun. Rage made me reckless. When I stepped off that ferry at Dover, it wasn't really the encroaching pandemic I was escaping, although that was definitely creeping off the ferry behind me. Reluctantly, I was going home. Until my card refused to pay for a train ticket. Home was still where I was heading when I stood by the side of the road coming out of the port. We'd done it in Italy when we'd been stuck for a lift, and now I was fearless, my arm like gold in the March evening sun as I extended my thumb. The car looked a bit boho, and the family in it seemed interesting, then intriguing, then seriously crazy, and only later, sinister. But that spring of 2020 was crazy for the world at large. It was easy to get lost, to lose contact. And I was angry with Luke and Lottie and my father, all of which made what happened possible.
It was meant to be Caitlin's perfect summer, but betrayed by her best friend and her boyfriend, she finds herself hitchhiking home alone, heartbroken and penniless. When a smiling family pulls up on the roadside to help her on her way, she's relieved. They seem so friendly, safe. And when they offer her a warm bed in their isolated house for the night, she's grateful not to have to travel back alone in the dark. In any case, she's in no rush to get home, where a grave secret is lying in wait to blow her family apart. One night soon turns to two, and then three. The increasingly spellbinding couple wants her to stay. And why shouldn't she? Their children need a tutor, and the longer she can avoid home, the better. But when an older member of the household warns her to leave immediately, and when her phone suddenly goes missing, she realises that this perfect family is a perfect lie, and it might not be so easy for her to leave.
I always thought Betrayal would be more uniform, like a perfectly square slab of something bitter that you could cut into chunks and work your way through bit by bit, and then you'd be done with it. But it seemed to be eating me instead, nibble by nibble, reaching further and further into the deepest seams of my self-worth. I imagined shooting Luke, then gunning Lottie down for good measure. I'd wished him on the ferry with me so that I could shove him off the back and watch him disappear, shocked, into the foaming wake. But yes, I know, adrenaline fueled by rage. It could never end well. If I think about it too much, I'll have to admit that a lot of the anger was with myself. Being blind to hideous betrayal is just about forgivable, but blind to such emotional stinginess, happy to take such tiny crumbs of attention and tell myself it was enough, that's the worst kind of pathetic. I failed to see Luke's true intent, when all the while he was feasting greedily on my last teenage year. Part of my job was to attribute cleverness to him, to in awe of him, to see that he was just older than me, fairly bright but unoriginal. I do feel shoddy about leaving without giving any explanation to Lottie's boyfriend, Tom, though. He was a good friend to me. He was the only thin membrane between Luke's contempt for me and my contempt for myself.
Stay by Jane Bailey is read by Imogen Church and runs for 14 hours.
The Moongate by Amanda Geard is a story that spans the decades. It was given to us by Headline.
The absence of greenery in Covent Garden wasn't so much a surprise to Libby Andrews as an inevitability. The city she thought she might recognise from Monopoly boards, Dickens, and programmes on the telly was buried beneath a shiny present that concealed its history until she peeled away the layers and searched for what hid beneath. From the bomb-scarred facade of the V&A to the muddy course of the Thames, itself a repository for centuries of the city's flotsam, London's piled past was slowly coming alive for Libby as she walked its endless streets. But it wasn't the city's history that had brought her to the dingy waiting room a stone's throw from Waterloo Station. It was her own.
1939. On the eve of war, young English heiress Grace Grey travels from London to the wilderness of Tasmania. Coaxed out of her shell by the attentions of her Irish neighbour Daniel, Grace finally learns to live. But when Australian forces are called to the front line, and Daniel with them, he leaves behind a devastating secret which will forever bind them together. 1975. Artist Willow Hawkins and her new husband Ben can't believe their luck when an anonymous benefactor leaves them a house on the remote Tasmanian coast. Confused and delighted, they set out to unmask Towerhurst's previous owner, unwittingly altering the course of their lives. 2004. Libby Andrews has always been sheltered from the truth behind her father Ben's death. When she travels to London and discovers a faded photograph, a long-buried memory is unlocked, and she begins to follow an investigation which Ben could never complete. But will she realise that some secrets are best left buried?
Number 13. Libby stood quickly and stepped up to the counter, cursing her superstition as she slid the docket and her letters through the square hole in the glass with shaking hands. If only she'd left her aunt's apartment earlier and not boarded the wrong bus. Indeed, if she'd overcome her doubts sooner and done this immediately when she'd arrived in London, she might well have been number one. But when had she ever been first? She never won, never pushed herself forward, and even now she stepped back from the counter to give the rotund man behind the glass plenty of space. Immediately, she began to babble. I wrote to the coroner's archive 6 months ago to confirm the box hadn't been destroyed. You can see the dates on the two letters, the first one in 1975 and the other in 2004. Can't you? She hesitated, but the man remained unmoved. I've come a really long way. From Tasmania, in fact. Usually, mention of the island piqued interest, prompting a story about a visit, or more often than not, an intention to visit. But the man only turned her letters over with chubby fingers, as though doubting their authenticity, oblivious to the charms of Australia's southernmost state and those who hailed from it. Behind Libby, three people waited, each clutching their little blue tickets, each perched on one of the uncomfortable plastic seats lined up along the wall. Feeble daylight washed down from a high window that showcased passing feet splashing through the downpour, the sound of rain-pummeled pavement drowned out by a grumbling vent whose warm air ruffled the diminutive foliage of a palm standing bravely next to the counter. That plant, Libby thought, as she watched the man's concrete expression, was the only indication that a human being worked here at all. The room smelled of wet dog and yesterday's lunch, and although Christmas was less than a month away, it was nowhere to be found amongst the signs that barked at those who waited.
The Moon Gate by Amanda Geard is read by Natalie Pella and runs for 17 hours, 46 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Hello, I'm Diana Bishop, and you're listening to Talking Books. I've been reading for RNIB Talking Books for many years, and thoroughly enjoyed every minute of it. One of my favourite books was Jacob's Room by Virginia Woolf. The reason I loved it so much was because the writing is so good that the words come off the paper like cream.
So, of course, wrote Betty Flanders, pressing her heels rather deeper in the sand. There was nothing for it but to leave. Slowly welling from the point of her gold nib, pale blue ink dissolved the full stop. For there her pen stuck, her eyes fixed, and tears slowly filled them. The entire bay quivered, the lighthouse wobbled, and she had the illusion that the mast of Mr. Connor's little yacht was bending like a wax candle in the sun. She winked quickly. Accidents were awful things. She winked again. The mast was straight, the waves were regular, the lighthouse was upright. But the blot had spread.
I think the service is invaluable, because there are so many people who can't read books, not just the people who are normally thought of, like the blind, but also people who have arthritic hands, perhaps, and can't turn the pages, and all sorts of other reasons. I love the job because I love everybody concerned with it. I like the other readers and all the technicians who help so much. And I really enjoy narrating because, well, you get to play all the parts. You play all the leading parts and all the small parts, and that's very, very rewarding.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally, on today's edition of Read On, the audiobook show, a return to Hester Musson for the books of our life. Now, Hester, is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Yes, there were very many, but one that springs to mind is A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, because it's one that my mother used to read to me and my brother in the run-up to Christmas. And she is an extraordinary reader. She is so good at it. She could easily be an audiobook reader. So that lovely feeling of being read to. And the story itself, I just absolutely adore. I love Dickens anyway. And I think the first line is my favourite in all of literature. Marley was dead to begin with. I absolutely love ghost stories, and especially Victorian ghost stories. So that just encapsulates everything, that excitement and knowing that you're in the hands of an amazing writer. Just, yeah, it's brilliant. I have to kind of ration myself each year about, you know, I can't read it every year because I don't want to wear it out.
Marley was dead to begin with. There is no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker, and the chief mourner. Scrooge signed it. And Scrooge's name was good upon change for anything he chose to put his hand to. Old Marley was as dead as a doornail. Mind, I don't mean to say that I know of my own knowledge what there is particularly dead about a doornail. I might have been inclined myself to regard a coffin nail as the deadest piece of ironmongery in the trade. But the wisdom of our ancestors is in the simile, and my unhallowed hands shall not disturb it, or the country's done for. You will therefore permit me to repeat emphatically that Marley was as dead as a doornail. Scrooge knew he was dead? Of course he did. How could it be otherwise? Scrooge and he were partners for I don't know how many years. Scrooge was his sole executor, his sole administrator, his sole assign, his sole residuary legatee, his sole friend, and sole mourner. And even Scrooge was not so dreadfully cut up by the sad event, but that he was an excellent man of business on the very day of the funeral, and solemnized it with an undoubted bargain. The mention of Marley's funeral brings me back to the point I started from. There is no doubt that Marley was dead. This must be distinctly understood, for nothing wonderful can come of the story I'm going to relate. If we were not perfectly convinced that Hamlet's father died before the play began, there would be nothing more remarkable in his taking a stroll at night in an easterly wind upon his own ramparts than there would be in any other middle-aged gentleman rashly turning out after dark in a breezy spot, say St. Paul's Churchyard, for instance, literally to astonish his son's weak mind. Scrooge never painted out old Marley's name. There it stood, years afterwards, above the warehouse door. Scrooge and Marley. The firm was known as Scrooge and Marley. Sometimes people new to the business called Scrooge Scrooge, and sometimes Marley. But he answered to both names. It was all the same to him.
A Christmas Carol is available in many audio versions. It's also available from RNIB Talking Books in both audio and braille. The audio version you've just heard was read by Maurice Turner. And is there a book on a rainy day you would go back to again and happily reread?
Yes, I don't tend to reread books very much at the moment, but one book I do find myself returning to a lot is Possession by A.S. Byatt. If I'm in a slump with the writing and can't remember what a good sentence looks like, it's the book I always turn to try and rev my engines again and feel inspired. But then once I start doing that, I end up just sitting there for an hour and I've just found myself reading, because she's also such a great storyteller. You immediately get sucked in again. But I love that book. I love all of her writing, actually. You could feel the passion of the writer in the writing, of how interested she is. And that one is a sort of literary detective story. So it has all the elements. I love it.
The book was thick and black and covered with dust. Its boards were bowed and creaking. It had been maltreated in its own time. Its spine was missing, or rather protruded from amongst the leaves like a bulky marker. It was bandaged about and about with dirty white tape tied in a neat bow. The librarian handed it to Roland Michel, who was sitting waiting for it in the reading room of the London Library. It had been exhumed from locked safe number 5 where it usually stood between pranks of Priapus and the Grecian way of love. It was 10 in the morning, one day in September 1986. Roland had the small single table he liked best, behind a square pillar, with the clock over the fireplace nevertheless in full view. To his right was a high sunny window, through which you could see the high green leaves of St. James's Square. The London Library was Roland's favourite place. It was shabby but civilised, alive with history but inhabited also by living poets and thinkers who could be found squatting on the slotted metal floors of the stacks, or arguing pleasantly at the turning of the stair. Here Carlyle had come. Here George Eliot had progressed through the bookshelves. Roland saw her black silk skirts, her velvet trains, sweeping compressed between the fathers of the church, and heard her firm foot ring on metal among the German poets. Here Randolph Henry Ashe had come, cramming his elastic mind and memory with unconsidered trifles from history and topography, from the felicitous alphabetical conjunctions of science and miscellaneous, dancing, deaf and dumb, death, dentistry, devil and demonology, distribution, dogs, domestic servants, dreams. In his day, works on evolution had been catalogued under pre-Adamite man. Roland had only recently discovered that the London Library possessed Ashe's own copy of Vico's Principi di Scienza Nuova. Ashe's books were most regrettably scattered across Europe and America. By far the largest single gathering was, of course, in the Stant collection at Robert Dale Owen University in New Mexico, where Mortimer Cropper worked on his monumental edition of the complete correspondence of Randolph Henry Ashe. That was no problem nowadays. Books travelled the ether like light and sound. But it was just possible that Ashe's own Vico had marginalia missed even by the indefatigable Cropper. And Roland was looking for sources for Ashe's Garden of Proserpina. And there was a pleasure to be had from reading the sentences Ashe had read, touched with his fingers, scanned with his eyes.
Possession by A.S. Byatt is available both commercially and in the RNIB Talking Books Library, as read by Samuel West. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend.
Yes, well, it was out this year, actually, Yellow Face by Rebecca F. Kwong. It's just such a fun riot of a book. It's sort of sitting, you can almost read it in one sitting. And it was great for me because it's all about the publishing process. And it's a great premise. It's about two writers. One is an absolute star and sort of literary darling, and the other one just isn't getting ahead at all. And they're friends, and then the star dies in a freak accident, and the friend steals her unpublished manuscripts and passes it off as her own, and then obviously absolute chaos ensues. And it's more depth as well. It's about identity and white privilege as well. I found myself reading it as a sort of handbook because it does go through the writer's experience of big publishing. So I found myself almost sort of making mental notes of like, oh, okay, you can expect this, and yeah, don't do that. But it is, it's a really, really fun read.
The night I watched Athena Liu die, we're celebrating her TV deal with Netflix. Off the bat, for this story to make sense, you should know two things about Athena. First, she has everything. A multi-book deal straight out of college at a major publishing house, an MFA from the one writing workshop everyone's heard of, a resume of prestigious artist residencies, and a history of awards nominations longer than my grocery list. At 27, she's published three novels, each one a successively bigger hit. For Athena, the Netflix deal was not a life-changing event, just another feather in her cap. One of the side perks of the road to literary stardom she's been hurtling down since graduation. Second, perhaps as a consequence of the first, she has almost no friends. Writers our age, young, ambitious, up-and-comers just this side of 30, tend to run in packs. You'll find evidence of cliques all over social media. Writers gushing over excerpts of one another's unpublished manuscripts, losing my head over this WIP, squealing over cover reveals. This is so gorgeous, I will die. And posting selfies of group hangs at literary meetups across the globe. But Athena's Instagram photos feature no one else. She regularly tweets career updates and quirky jokes to her 70,000 followers, but she rarely adds other people. She doesn't name drop, doesn't blurb or recommend her colleagues' books, and doesn't publicly rub shoulders in that ostentatious, desperate way early career writers do. In the entire time I've known her, I've never heard her reference any close friends but me. I used to think that she was simply aloof. Athena is so stupidly, ridiculously successful that it makes sense she wouldn't want to mingle with mere mortals. Athena presumably chats exclusively with blue check holders and fellow best-selling authors who can entertain her with their rarefied observations on modern society. Athena doesn't have time to make friends with proletarians. But in recent years, I've developed another theory, which is that everyone else finds her as unbearable as I do. It's hard, after all, to be friends with someone who outshines you at every turn. Probably no one else can stand Athena because they can't stand constantly failing to measure up to her. Probably I'm here because I'm just that pathetic. So that night, it's only Athena and me at a loud, overpriced rooftop bar in Georgetown. She's flinging back cocktails like she has a duty to prove she's having a good time, and I'm drinking to dull the bitch in me that wishes she were dead.
Yellowface by R.F. Kuang is available from RNIB Talking Books and commercially. Both versions are read by Helen Laser. And once again, Hester, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's been really lovely.
All we've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week, but remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.